Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop update on glioblastoma. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in the program today that we have so many participants on the call today. Now, we have over 772 participants on the call, and you come from all of the United States, from all different regions. And we also have international participants from Canada, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you're a global call, really, from all over the world. Today's program has been made possible by grants from Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, and NovoCure. And I really want to thank them for their support of the program. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you have received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is information about our speakers and the topics they'll be addressing, as well as all of our collaborating organizations as resources for each of you. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, you are really our best people to tell us what our programs really should look like, what topics we should cover. Indeed, this topic for today on glioblastoma is one that many of you have requested that we offer a program on this, and so here it is. So please tell us what you'd like us to do, what you liked about the program, your recommendations, and we take them quite seriously. And we are planning many programs for this coming year so that your recommendations could not come at a more timely moment. Now, I would like to say that we have wonderful speakers on our program today, really just terrific speakers. And I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Bruce. And Dr. Bruce is Edgar M. Houspian, Professor of Neurological Surgery. He is Vice Chairman, Department of Neurosurgery at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. He is also co-director, Brain Tumor Center, and director, Bartoli Brain Tumor Research Laboratory. Dr. Bruce is going to address an overview of glioblastoma. He's going to present current standard of care and novel treatment approaches. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Bruce.
Thank you. I'd like to welcome everybody out there on this teleconference and say a special thanks to Cancer Care. This is a wonderful organization that has helped many people and families over the years, and I thank them for organizing this today. I'm going to begin by giving an overview of glioblastoma and the current standards of care and some ideas about novel treatment approaches. First of all, you should know that there are about 40,000 brain tumors that are diagnosed in the United States every year. And we distinguish between two types of brain tumors, what we call primary brain tumors, which are those tumors that actually begin in the brain. Those are tumors like glioblastoma, as compared to metastatic brain tumors, which are tumors that have spread from somewhere else in the body. Today, we'll be talking about primary brain tumors, which are, those tumors that begin in the brain. Now, glioblastomas can spread to other parts of the brain or spinal cord, but they rarely metastasize or spread elsewhere throughout the body. They do grow into the brain, so they are invasive into brain tissue, and that means that you will get tumor cells as they invade into the brain, where you have a mixture of tumor cells as well as normal brain cells side by side, and that's what makes the treatment for these rather difficult. Current treatment standards include some form of surgery followed by radiation and chemotherapy. Now, primary brain tumors or brain tumors in general are often graded. They're considered either low grade or slow growing as opposed to high grade or fast growing. And low grade tumors can progress over time into high grade tumors. So tumors can sometimes contain a mixture of different cell types. They can be both low and high grade, although the highest grade of the tumor cell present is what determines the treatment and usually affects how the tumor is going to behave going forward. Now, a lot of people have been wondering about whether there's an actual a higher incidence of brain tumors. In other words, are there more brain tumors now than before? And there seems to be some trend for that, particularly in elderly patients. Some of this may be just due to the fact that we can detect the tumors better, we can diagnose them more easily, but there may be something related to the fact that the number of these tumors are increasing because of certain causes for brain tumors. Now, the cause of brain tumors has been an area of research, but there are really no good explanations for what causes a brain tumor. We know that it has to do to some degree with genetics and what you're born with, but that doesn't mean that these tumors are passed on from generation to generation in families. We do know that there may be some relationship to radiation and electromagnetic fields, possibly viruses, possibly injury, but these have been studied in pretty good detail, and nobody has really been able to find a strong relationship between these things. And a lot of people ask about cell phones, and while we know that cell phones do contain a very small amount of electromagnetic fields, there has not been any real conclusive correlation between cell phones and brain tumors. Now, when someone has a brain tumor, the kind of problems they develop usually has to do with where the tumor is located. Some people will develop headaches, which may be worse in the morning. Some people will have a seizure. That's a fairly common presentation for this. And some people will have other signs of pressure, such as nausea or vomiting or some visual difficulties. Other people will have symptoms based on where the tumor is located in the brain. So if the tumor is in a motor area where the movement of your hand is located, then you may have some trouble moving your hand. If it's in the back of the head in the cerebellum, you may have balance problems. So a lot of this depends on where the tumor is located. And when someone has symptoms, they'll often get some kind of a scan using an MRI scan, and that will allow the physicians to make the diagnosis. Now, the current standard of care involves some form of surgery, followed by usually 6 weeks of radiation, and then chemotherapy with a drug called Temodar. The first step in this process is surgery. And the goals of surgery usually are to remove as much tumor as possible, the limitation being that, as I mentioned before, that tumor cells invade into the brain. So where you get a mixture of tumor cells mixing in with normal brain cells, that's often a limiting factor in how much of the tumor can be removed. The other thing that surgery does is allows the pathologist to look at the tumor that's removed and establish the diagnosis. And once this is done, it provides a way for other treatments to be more easily facilitated. So to remove a tumor, surgeons perform what's known as a craniotomy, which means they open up this skull, and there are a variety of different tools that are used to help remove the tumor, sometimes lasers, other times ultrasonic aspirators, the microscope. And some patients actually have surgery while they're awake if their tumor is in a part of the brain where speech or important motor function is located. That way the surgeon can monitor your speech or your movement as the tumor is being removed. When someone is first diagnosed with a brain tumor, they're usually put on some kind of steroids to reduce the amount of swelling that the tumor causes. And steroids, the most common steroid is something called dexamethasone. That removes some of the symptoms that are related to swelling. And steroids have to be closely monitored. And once the tumor is removed and radiation is finished, normally the steroids are gradually tapered. Usually you don't like to stop these medications all at once, or you can have withdrawal effects from that. The side effects that people get from steroids include everything from acne to increased appetite and weight gain to mood changes, difficulty sleeping. And those things can usually resolve very quickly once the medication is gradually tapered. Most people with a brain tumor will be on seizure medication to prevent seizures. Not everybody needs to be on seizure medication, so that's something that you should discuss individually with your neuro-oncologist. The most common side effects from seizure medicine are allergies and dizziness and occasionally fatigue. Now, once someone has had surgery to remove their tumor, they will then undergo radiation therapy. The most common type of radiation therapy is called external beam, and this is given usually up to 30 treatments. So the way this works is you come in to the radiation center once a day for 30 days. Usually it's done Monday through Friday for 6 weeks, and usually have the weekends off. And you have the radiation turned on for usually a few minutes a day. The most common side effects are some skin irritation where the radiation is given. Some people have hair loss, and it's not uncommon to have fatigue. That is to be tired after you go through a number of these treatments. The good news is that most of these side effects improve over time. And the radiation doesn't always work immediately. As the radiation is given over that six-week period, it's only after you've received enough radiation that the radiation begins to work. And the radiation will actually continue to work many weeks and even months later as it begins to kill all of those tumor cells. In addition to surgery and radiation, most people will be on some kind of chemotherapy. And the most common chemotherapy nowadays is something called temozolomide, which has been proven in a number of clinical trials to have the best effect against brain tumors. And the current standard of care then is to remove as much tumor as possible with surgery, followed by 6 weeks of radiation, and then the Temodar chemotherapy. And the good news with Temodar is that Temodar is given in a pill form, so you just take a pill, and you don't necessarily have to be in the hospital hooked up to a lot of intravenous connections, and it's just taking the pill is sufficient. Now, I'm going to finish my segment by mentioning some of the new advances that are out there in the treatment of gliomas. So once someone has had radiation and Temodar chemotherapy, if their tumor grows back after that, then you begin to look at other types of treatments that are usually in the area of experimental treatments. And there are a number of very exciting research that's being done in the field of brain tumors. Some of them have to do with ways to give chemotherapy more directly into the tumor, and that includes everything from polymers that are placed into the tumor cavity after the tumor is removed, and these polymers can dissolve over time, releasing chemotherapy into the tumor. The other is something called convection-enhanced delivery, where small catheters are placed in the tumor and the drugs are slowly pumped into the tumor itself. That way you avoid all of the side effects of the drug as it stays within the tumor rather than circulating throughout the entire body. The other is giving drugs directly into the arteries through an angiogram where doctors may put a catheter directly into the arteries next to the tumor and inject the drug right into the arteries. So those are some of the areas that are being done to maximize how much of a drug can be given. Then there's a fair amount of research that's being done on novel chemotherapy agents. That is, new and different types of drugs that may have better effects. Some of these you may already be familiar with, such as Avastin, which is a drug that blocks the blood vessels in the tumor. There are other drugs that prevent the tumor cells from invading into the brain. And there are a variety of different growth factor inhibitors and other drugs we call molecular biologics that are drugs that have been developed specifically after scientists have looked at all of the molecular biology changes that occur in a given tumor, and they're able to come up with drugs that specifically target these changes. Finally, I want to mention the field of immunotherapy and vaccines. And these are some new methods that involve using the body's own immune system to kill tumor cells. And this includes everything from vaccines to specific antibodies that are developed and a number of different ways that the immune system can be sort of supercharged so that it remains so it has a stronger effect against the tumor and your body's own immune system is able to work against the tumor the same way it would in a bacterial infection or a viral infection. So let me just end by saying this is an exciting time to be working in the field of brain tumors because there's now more research than ever being done. There's some promising new treatments on the horizon that are being tested right now, and physicians are beginning to apply the years of basic research that have been done trying to examine brain tumors and what causes them to grow and what can stop them from growing. A lot of this information is now being worked into new treatments and new clinical trials that are out there. And I will end there and we'll turn this over to Dr. Wong.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dr. Bruce. That was really an excellent and very informative and comprehensive overview of glioblastoma and its treatments and the new treatments as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Eric Wong. And Dr. Wong is with the Brain Tumor Center and Neuro-Oncology Unit, Harvard Medical School, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And Dr. Wong is going to address electric field therapy, the important role of clinical trials and how research contributes to your treatment options, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Wong.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Messner. And it is a real pleasure here to talk to all of you regarding new and exciting FDA-approved treatments. And this is available in the United States, and it is in Europe. And this treatment is called NovoTTF-100A, and which uses intermediate-frequency electric field to treat glioblastoma. The device was approved in 2011 by the Food and Drug Administration in the United States for use in patients with recurrent glioblastoma. The electric fields are applied onto the scalp and are known to penetrate through the skull into the brain tissue. Now, the way it works is that these electric fields disrupt the mechanisms that enable the tumor cells to divide. And the end result is that the tumor cells in the brain cannot divide properly, and as a result, these tumor cells disintegrate with time. The NovoTTF device has been shown to have equivalent efficacy as chemotherapy in phase 3 clinical trials, but the side effects from the device are substantially fewer and less severe than traditional chemotherapy. Just for your information, traditional chemotherapies can have abdominal side effects as well as a drop in blood counts. This device has a different set of side effects and primarily has to do with skin changes on the scalp. So NovoTTF-100A works just as well but has fewer side effects when compared to traditional chemotherapy or drug treatment. So I just want to spend a little bit of time because on how of your involvement in clinical trials, because this is very important because we as physicians, we need your help in terms of bringing these new treatment options to you. And usually when there is a new treatment, it takes more than 10 years, maybe 20 years, in order to come into fruition, into real therapies. And it usually begins with an idea. And that idea includes things like blocking blood vessels, as in developing an anti-angiogenesis drug, or an idea of treating, dividing tumor cells with the electric field. And after all the experimental studies are done, then it goes into human testing in phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 settings. And in phase 1 testing, it is primarily used to determine toxicity. And once we find the appropriate dose, then it goes into phase 2 testing. And phase 2 testing primarily involves administering the new drug or treatment to a small number of patients usually about 15 to 20 individuals, just to get a rough idea of the effectiveness. But the most critical part is phase 3 testing, in which the new treatment is compared against the conventional treatment. And it is typically randomized, meaning that your treating doctor cannot decide which treatment you will be on. And if possible, blinded. Your doctor may not know whether or not you're getting the treatment, and you may not even know whether or not you're getting the treatment. Now, this type of trial can involve hundreds and perhaps thousands of patients. And at the end of the trial, when all these statistics are analyzed, if the trial data looks good, then the next step is going to the Food and Drug Administration to be examined again by a new set of eyes within the Food and Drug Administration, as well as the panel of experts that they assemble. And yes, you as a patient can offer your impact statement during the FDA panel meeting, actually. So that's how new treatments are coming into pictures for you. And in terms of the day-to-day management, how you are communicating to your healthcare team, I just want to make two points. There are two facets in managing patients like you. The first one, treating the tumor, is obvious, and I've spent the first 10 minutes and Dr. Bruce have spent time talking about that. The second one, however, is a little bit less obvious, and it involves management or maximizing your brain function, how to protect you from treatment side effects, reversing cognitive decline, maximizing the remaining function, how to deal with work, continuing working while you're receiving treatment. It is also important for you to assemble a support network, how to fill out disability application, driving issues, and adaptive mechanisms at home. And it is the second part that we need your help. So it is very important for you before your doctor's visits to write down your questions and discuss with your oncologist or his nurse practitioners about your concerns. Do not hesitate in picking up the phone make contact with them, because there are certain things like small seizures can sometimes turn into big seizures that is harder to deal with. So when in doubt, pick up the phone and speak to your oncologist. And there are a number of things that neurologists and neuro-oncologists can help you to maximize your function, such as I said before, how to control seizures, prevent before disabilities comes into the picture. There are drugs that can help to maximize your cognitive function. Weaning off the Decadron would be helpful, because this would avoid the problem of suppressing your immune system and also preventing some patients becoming a diabetic and also preventing muscle weakness. Your healthcare team can potentially look for prevent development of other side effects from medications or immobility. So to summarize, I think we oncologists, neuro-oncologists, and laboratory scientists are working hard for you in developing new treatments for your brain tumor. Helping you requires a two-pronged approach, in my opinion, treating the tumor as well as maximizing your neurological function. And you can help by participating in clinical trials and speaking to your congressmen and senators about funding brain tumor research. Let your doctor know, or the assistant, or his or her assistant know, what neurological, psychiatric, and social issues that are important to you. So with that in mind, I would like to turn over this event to the next speaker, Mary Elizabeth Davis. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Wong, for an excellent presentation and for very helpfully helping people understand about some of the more novel treatment approaches in terms of electric field therapy and the importance of communicating with their healthcare team, and also in terms of the really importance of research and clinical trials. So thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Mary Elizabeth Davis. And Mary Elizabeth Davis is an oncology nurse. She's an oncology clinical nurse specialist, Department of Ambulatory Nursing, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And she's going to address managing treatment side effects, quality of life concerns, and the role of rehabilitation medicine. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Davis.
Thank you very much. I would like to just start by saying in reference to what Dr. Wong and Dr. Bruce talked about, that we pretty much know the side effects that are expected for most of these treatments, and it's really important that patients communicate, and patients and their caregivers communicate with the healthcare team to really address them, because we don't know you're having them if you don't let us know about them. So I'll review some of the common common side effects that occur, and just some general ideas of what we can do to help that. During radiation, I know most patients experience some localized skin irritation, and some hair loss in the area that's being treated. Usually the radiation staff recommends skin moisturizers and gentle shampoos during this time. Sometimes the hair will grow back, sometimes it won't. It depends on the treatment dose. But it is important to remember with summer coming that that area needs to be covered by hats or sunscreen, because you will be more apt to get sunburn in the area where you had radiation. Probably one of the biggest side effects that most patients experience is fatigue. Fatigue is often very difficult to manage. It's often very difficult for the caregivers to deal with, but it is something that most patients experience. The type of fatigue really differs depending on where you are in your treatment. During radiation, the fatigue tends to be cumulative, where patients start off with the radiation because they're treated every day, 5 days a week, usually getting a chemotherapy pill all 7 days of the week during it. So patients sort of get progressively more fatigued as radiation goes on. You know, 6 weeks of radiation is a long time. And by the end, you know, the fourth, fifth, and definitely into the sixth week, it is normal to experience fatigue. It's important to note that the fatigue doesn't stop when radiation stops. It usually takes about 2 weeks for patients to start feeling better. And then gradually you will get your energy back and begin to feel better. During chemotherapy, and particularly during the chemotherapy that happens after the radiation is over, it seems to sort of come and go, that the fatigue is more prevalent during the days you're taking the chemotherapy pills and a few days after, and then you tend to progressively get better until it's time to take the chemotherapy again. Dealing with fatigue is somewhat of a catch-22 in that the patients are usually very tired, so therefore don't feel like they have the energy to get up and do something. But to be honest, getting up and exercising, even low-intensity exercises, getting up every day, getting out of the house, going to the mailbox and back, or doing a walk around the block, really helps improve fatigue. Because sometimes if patients tend to sit around and are more sedentary and don't get up and do something, they're actually more fatigued than those who can get up and do even some light exercise. And frequently the caregivers are the ones really to push the patient. If you find that the patient's been sitting sort of watching TV all day or sitting, that it might be important to get up and move a little. And then on the flip side is somebody who's always up on the go. It is sometimes important to balance exercise with rest. So it is something that's difficult to deal with, but it can help to get up and move around. Some of the other side effects from chemo really depends on the agent that you're being given, but Temodar or temozolomide is the most common medication we use. It usually is in a pill form that's given during radiation every day and then in a different schedule after radiation's over. Usually the side effects from this, such as nausea or taste changes or maybe constipation, tends to be a big issue. These usually are very well handled with medications or some dietary changes, and that's why it's really important to speak with the healthcare team so that they can individualize what you need to take or different ways that diet can help or supplements. Certainly, we monitor blood counts while you're on chemotherapy. It's very important that we make sure that the white blood count, which fights infection, and the platelets, which help with bleeding, we do monitor that while patients are on chemotherapy. So It's very important that any patient or caregiver report a fever to their healthcare team or any bleeding. With regard to the temozolomide, it is a pill, which is nice for patients to take. They don't need to come in and get IVs, but we need to remember that it is a chemotherapy pill, so it would be important for caregivers to use safe handling with this. We actually teach our caregivers, if you're giving the chemotherapy to your loved one, that you actually use gloves when you're doing it, and just to be careful that it is chemotherapy. It needs to be discarded properly. I know Dr. Bruce mentioned dexamethasone, which is the steroid that patients sometimes get after surgery. Sometimes patients need it during radiation. And at times, if the tumor comes back, sometimes dexamethasone or the steroid is prescribed. This is commonly a large source of side effects. Frequently, the patient can be irritable or have mood changes. They can feel a little bit wired and have difficulty sleeping. It can affect your blood sugars, maybe cause a little weight gain or swelling in the ankles. And over time, the longer you're on the steroid, it can affect the muscles, I think Dr. Wong mentioned, in your legs, particularly causing difficulty for patients getting up out of chairs or going upstairs. We certainly try to limit the amount of steroids patients get and like to taper them off slowly. But it is important to bring up these concerns if you're having any with your healthcare team, and we can help with things like scheduling the steroids not too late at night so patients can sleep, or sometimes using sleeping pills or things like that. Certainly, rehabilitation services are able to be used for this. Physical therapy can be especially helpful to help with patients that might have some weakness on one side of the body or maybe weakness from being on the steroids. Physical therapy can come up with a plan to help recondition after surgery or help get back some of the function that the patients have lost. It is important to do not just the physical therapy when you're at the physical therapy department, but to be doing your exercises when you're home and to be reinforcing that. We certainly use occupational therapy. Occupational therapists can come up with some useful aids to help patients to do their normal daily activities, whether they're having trouble opening jars or reaching items for canes and walkers and things like that. And finally, we do often use cognitive rehab. We can do some testing and sort of offer and help plan activities to help things like improve working with numbers or memory. We can use speech services to help with patients that might have difficulty speaking or help with pronunciation. And we can use computer games and sometimes some medications to help with the cognitive rehab. The most important thing, I think, is that we individualize the care for each patient depending on what they're having. You know, not everybody needs physical therapy. Not everybody needs certain medications. So really the communication with the healthcare team is really important so that we can manage the symptoms to allow the good quality of life while the patient is doing it. And lastly, again, speaking about your concerns, we do want the patients to be active at home, to be able to work if you can, to manage your daily life, and support is very important for both the patient and the caregivers. So at this time, I think I'd turn it over to Sarah, who's going to speak about some of the supportive services that both cancer care offers and the role of support groups.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mary Elizabeth Davis. I want to thank you very much for that excellent presentation and really for your sensitivity to the management of side effects and to the role of rehabilitative medicine as well and quality of life issues. And, yes, our next speaker is Sarah Kelly, and Sarah is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care, and Sarah is going to address the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care as well as the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Carolyn. Carolyn said, I am an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I work with many people with glioblastoma and also their loved ones. Dr. Wong, I think, first talked about the support network, and certainly Mary Elizabeth Davis also talked about this and how important it is to create that. And what I really want to talk about is how Cancer Care can be a part of that support network. I think there are a lot of ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our cancer care programs include individual counseling. We do that face-to-face in the New York area and over the telephone nationally. We have support groups that we do face-to-face in the New York area. We do them over the phone and also online nationally. We have education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and also some limited financial assistance, as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and they are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They're also trained to help cancer patients and their loved ones tackle the problems that accompany the disease. You know, I think Dr. Wong mentioned the, you know, filling out paperwork. There's financial demands. Everyone talked about the physical changes, especially with this diagnosis. You know, and then there's social adjustment, psychological impact and care. You know, cancer affects the whole person and also the support network. I think adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process, you know, along with the treatment. I really want to stress that asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. You don't have to do this alone. You don't have to walk the path by yourself. You know, in a support group, you're really connecting with others who are going through a similar situation or having similar problems. I think there's a lot to be found there. Individual counseling, you really have a space that's yours to voice concerns. I think at the end of the day, the connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. I think feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. If you're interested in any of our services, please call our Hope line. It's 1-800-813-HOPE, and you can connect right with one of our oncology social workers. I also recommend, if you haven't, visiting our website. That's www.cancercare.org. It's a very comprehensive website. There's a lot of information on the website about your diagnosis, but also just coping with it. As you've learned today, there's kind of a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. We can help you understand what it means for you and your family. So, you know, I definitely recommend connecting with us. Your social worker really can help you prioritize and, you know, talking about the medical team, really help you kind of gather questions, rehearse them if you need to. You know, at the end of the day, I really want you to remember you're not alone in this. We're here to help you. Thank you, everyone, for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah. That's really very wonderful and very warm and compassionate presentation about the service of cancer care and how we are really there for all of you on the call today. Now, I want to thank all of our speakers. They've been terrific. And now we have time for questions. And we have lots of time for questions. So I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board and actually and to explain to people how to queue up for questions. And we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. If for some reason you don't get to ask your question, or you think of a question after the program that you'd like to ask, all you have to do is call our 800 number at 1-800-813-4673. And I'll repeat that number at the end of the call as well. But for now, why don't we see the questions that we can take? So, Kate, could you explain to everybody how to queue up the questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit a question by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from the line of Mindy Kay. Your line is open.
Hi. I've recently started working with cancer patients, and the GBMs are one of the groups that people are working with. And a lot of patients are coming and asking me about using the ketogenic diet. I'm a registered dietitian. They've been asking about using the ketogenic diet as a possible treatment. And I was wondering, I know it's currently in the research stage. It hasn't really, you know, it's not really out there as a science-based, you know, evidence-based management. But I was wondering if any of you are using that and what you thought about, you know, advising patients on using the ketogenic diet.
Okay, well, thank you for that question. Well, that's a very good point. I think that so anything that you hear about that you wish to try or do, whether it has to do with food or a vitamin or anything like that, definitely discuss it with your medical team, with your physician, with your healthcare team, other members of the team, before you embark on it. That's really very important. Dr. Pruse, can you comment on that? Because sometimes people want to take, like, some sort of vitamin supplement or something else when they're in the midst of their treatment, and sometimes those things interact with treatment and don't quite all work together.
Yeah, I think I would say a few things in general. I think the best advice in terms of lifestyle is the same advice that you hear over and over again for all kinds of health, and that is to, you know, watch your diet, watch what you eat, get enough sleep, get some exercise, get enough rest. I mean, those are all general things, and I think that's adhering to those principles are really very important to keep you in the best shape possible. When it comes to when we start to encroach on the area of alternative treatments, and that includes everything from vitamins to herbal therapies, things of that nature, I think you'll find that most physicians don't object to those things. As long as they're not harmful and as long as they don't prevent you from getting the other treatments that we know are useful and work. And I think part of the problem is that there are a lot of different misinformation out there, and obviously everybody wants to find a treatment that's going to work for them, and if it sounds like it's too easy and too simple and too good, then it probably is. So I think there's nothing wrong with considering alternative treatments, including vitamins, medications, and diets, but do it in conjunction with your neuro-oncologist and your physician so that you talk things over to make sure it's not harmful and make sure that it doesn't prevent you from getting treatments that you need.
That's an excellent point. And many hospitals now have what we call integrative medicine departments. And Mary Elizabeth, can you comment on that? Because I know you have a strong program there, and how that all works with one's physician and healthcare team as well.
We do. We have a very popular integrative and complementary center where you can meet with both dietitians, physicians, look over supplements when people, for instance, want to take St. John's Wort or some of the other supplements. They really have a background of looking into what interactions it might have with your chemotherapy treatment, you know, the high antioxidants and things like that. So it is important, and they can, you know, we for instance, have appointments not only for dietary things, but for acupuncture and some massage therapy and things like that that can complement treatment.
Excellent. And that's all done in conjunction with one's health,
yes.
With one's physician.
Yes,
always. Okay. Okay, so I hope you all take that away from this, that there, you may hear lots of ideas out there, but it's most important to run them past your treating physician. That's really important, and healthcare team. So we have a question actually from one of our online participants, from John, actually. The question is, what are the risks involved in a craniotomy? Dr. Bruce, could you address that?
I'm sorry, what's that question again?
What are the risks involved in a craniotomy?
Well, the risks involved in a craniotomy have to do mostly with where the tumor is located. And so there are many parts of the brain that don't have really important function, and the risks of surgery in those locations are much less. And that includes areas of the frontal lobe, the part of the brain in the front, and to some degree the parietal lobe, which is mostly has to do with sensation, your ability to feel things. Tumors that are located in the motor area of the brain are at higher risk to affect your movement in your hands, your arms, your legs, and so that the risk is a little bit greater there. The same for tumors that are located in your speech areas, because speech and motor function are important, are very important functions. The risks of surgery in those locations are greater. The other types of general risks are the risk of such things as seizures, or hemorrhage, bleeding afterwards. And those are more general risks. I think you'll find that in reputable brain tumor centers around the country, the risks of surgery are very well controlled, and a good surgeon should be able to perform an operation to remove your tumor with with a 5 to 10% risk of a problem. That means 90 to 95% of the time you're going to be just fine after the surgery. These are just broad generalizations. Obviously, these depend on the individual case and what your tumor looks like and where it's located in the brain. But for the most part, I think the techniques for surgery have come a long way and are generally quite safe and certainly worth the risk is certainly worth the benefits that you get from having the tumor removed.
Excellent, thank you. And we have another question actually from Rosa, one of our online participants. How often can complete remissions after receiving treatment with chemotherapy and radiotherapy occur? Dr. Bruce, could you address that question in a general way? And then Rosa, we definitely recommend that you, of course, discuss with your healthcare team as well in terms of your own specific situation.
Well, when it comes to glioblastoma, these are malignant tumors. And I would say that most of the time with radiation and chemotherapy, there is at least a period of remission where the tumor does stop growing. And that happens in most patients that get that kind of an effect. The nature of these tumors is that they almost always grow back at some point. And so when we talk about remission, we would say that most people are in remission for a period of time, but that these tumors generally grow back, and they grow back at different rates in different people. How quickly they grow back probably has to do a lot with individual tumors and the different molecular biology, the different makeup of a given tumor. So it's hard to generalize for everybody. But to answer the first part of your question, though, most people with radiation and Temodar do experience at least some period of remission.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants, Alex, about NovoTTF. Who is the ideal candidate for this treatment? Dr. Wong, could you address this in a general way? And then we'll ask Alex to go back to his healthcare team to discuss it further. But
okay, so in the NovoTTF 100A treatment, it requires these transducer arrays to be applied to the scalp. So it is important for patients to have intact skin on the scalp. The wound has to be healed. There are certain patients who just cannot get this device. It would not be feasible because we don't have a lot of data, and that is if the skull is removed because of infection or whatnot, that there is no skull there. We cannot apply this. The patient also should designate one or two family members as the key person to exchange the arrays because the patients certainly cannot exchange it themselves. They require family members to help them. And it requires shaving the hair, and it requires vigilance monitoring of changes on the scalp. Once those requirements are satisfied, patients can usually take that. Now, it's just my experience that for men, for our male patients, they usually don't give a second thought about shaving their hair. Women, it may take some time because of the shaving that is required because of changes in physique. But there are wigs that we can prescribe them, and also there are ways of making them look good.
Okay, excellent. And one other question from one of our online participants, from Sarah. Are there any new developments in immunotherapy treating glioblastoma? I know, Dr. Bruce, you mentioned this, but did you want to say a little bit more about this?
Yeah, there are the whole field of immunotherapy is a very big area in brain tumors these days. And, you know, the way this works is, everybody has an immune system. And you're most familiar with your immune system, that if you get a virus or a bacteria, your immune system sort of kicks in and gets rid of the virus or the bacteria. And it the immune system is designed to look at, to attack anything that is viewed as a foreign invader. And as it turns out, that tumors are actually viewed that way. Tumors appear to be like a foreign invader. So the immune system, when it encounters a tumor, will actually work to try and get rid of the tumor. The problem with glioblastoma is the tumor grows faster than the immune system is able to get rid of it. And so what scientists are doing is they're trying to understand what makes the immune system respond to a tumor, and they're developing treatments that are directed that way. And some of these treatments involve such things as vaccines. And vaccines are, you're probably familiar with vaccines for smallpox and mumps, different vaccines you've taken as children, and that's designed to prevent those infections from occurring. Well, scientists are taking people's tumor cells and processing them in such a way that they can remove the tumor cells, process them, and then inject them back into the patient in a way that stimulates their immune response. So a lot of this work is not very well understood, but we are beginning to understand just how powerful this system can be. And I think it's just a matter of time before we get better insight to how it works and can come up with better treatments for it.
That's excellent. Well, I want to thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. This has been an extraordinary program today. And I want to thank all of you who've sent us such wonderful questions online and all of you who've been listening. I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour workshop and that we recognize in planning a program like this that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So I just want to remind all of you that although the program will soon end, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those are endless, and you can call us at any time. Cancer Care does have a staff of oncology social workers here to help you with support and counseling, someone to talk to. We also have a number of different types of support groups for both people living with glioblastoma, living with cancer, and their caregivers and loved ones. And we also have, of course, a practical and financial assistance program here to help people as well. And we have a number of these workshops that you're certainly welcome to participate in. We're delighted to have all of you on the call today. And we have also materials and fact sheets and publications that we can send to all of you as well. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with glioblastoma, with cancer, in just coping in general. I want you to know that you're now part of the community of support, and we are here to help you. And we are simply a telephone call away. You can call us at 1-800-813-4673. And really, do take advantage of that service. It's a free service, and we're here really to provide all the help we can to each of you. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.